Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens, at the heart of Irish homes for over 40 years. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Hello, how are you? Hope you are all well. Between now and 12 on today's programme, where does Sinn Féin want to house asylum seekers? Congestion charging over car park levies, says the expert tax group. Day one of Olympic sporting action in Paris. We're in Galway ahead of Sunday's All-Ireland final. And preventing farm injuries with physio. Text us this morning on 51551. You can also email todaycb@rte.ie. Mary Lou McDonald, Sinn Féin leader, TD for Dublin Central. Very good morning to you.
Good morning.
I have to hand here your just launched immigration policy document, International Protection Affairs right. System That Works. Can we go through the detail of what it is that you're proposing here, please?
Certainly.
You've insisted okay. that some asylum centres should be placed in better off areas. Tell me why and give us an idea of the type of place you're talking about.
So good morning, and this obviously is a significant intervention by us. We said, but I should say this is only one slice of migration policy, but it's dealing with international protection, as you have said. And I suppose what makes this very distinct from the government's approach is that we place not alone human rights and respect for applicants centre stage, but also respect for and acknowledgement of communities on a par with that. And our position, just to cut straight to it, is that reception centres should not be located in very, very deprived areas.
At all?
At all. We believe that it is the wrong approach. If you look at what the government has been doing, their approach has been arbitrary. It's been very much ad hoc and driven by private provision. Our document deals with that. As you know, we are for the state providing this accommodation. It hasn't been planned properly. And in many cases, it has meant that facilities have been opened for very vulnerable cohorts of people in communities that are literally cut to the bone and struggling and not managing as things stand.
Okay.
And as a matter of basic...
Let's just tease this out, though, because you're absolutely right that placing these asylum centres in those communities has caused a number of very obvious problems. But do you necessarily solve those problems by moving from, say, Darndale and Coolock to Howth and Sutton? Because you might just find that the GP lists are just as busy, the school's just as bursting at the seams, and the public transport just as patchy.
Well, you see, we don't have to speculate on these matters. There are data sets available, the Pubble Deprivation Index, for example, data from the census, the CSO. And for other decisions, the state routinely will use those data to inform policy and the choices that are being made. What makes the issue of siting of international reception centres really, really at odds is that that approach is not taken at all. And not alone that, as and when decisions arbitrarily are taken about the siting of centres, there isn't then even an audit, a dialogue, a structured engagement or consultation with the community. So our approach, to summarise it, is to say simply this: you do not place these centres for very vulnerable cohorts of people who need support in very, very deprived, struggling, neglected areas, by the way, neglected by successive governments and for generations. And their neglect is the responsibility of government and government alone, not any newcomer to our shores. Let me make that absolutely clear. But they are not appropriate locations for these centres and services. where and we can objectively verify that it shouldn't be an arbitrary thing, where centres and where provision is located, equally there still has to be a dialogue, an engagement and a consultation with the wider community, because as a matter of basic common sense and good order, where change comes to any neighbourhood or community, where new people are introduced for whatever length of time to any neighbourhood or community, the sensible, orderly, friendly, constructive way to go about that is with maximum consultation and conversation, not the approach of the government, which has been to ignore all of that. And at the heart of our approach, therefore, is community. It's about living in the real world and recognising people's lived realities. It's about getting the system right in a way that protects our social cohesion and to have a system that enjoys public confidence.
What would be different under a Sinn Féin government, though? Would you hand those communities an effective veto at the end of a consultation process?
No, nobody has a veto, and I'm very taken
so,
with that.
So you're added in with the government then?
Well, let me say this about the government and vetoes. The government reaches for the veto argument as a rationale for not engaging with communities. I don't accept that. I think that's very cynical of them. Communities aren't looking for vetoes. Communities are looking for fair play, for fairness, for common sense, and for their voices to be heard. Because if, let me put it to you this way, I don't think anybody in any community, be it affluent or otherwise, would deny the right of people to comment, okay, to object, to participate in our planning system. There's no suggestion that anybody has a veto in that system. It's an open democratic process. The same standards, the same respect, the same conversation and democratic engagement has to exist when it comes to introducing and developing these centres.
What people might misunderstand from listening to you there is that these audits are actually happening already. This data is being used and there is a process of engagement and consultation that is ongoing.
I
need to get to your document. Mary Lou MacDonald.
I have to refute that.
We've already heard what it is that you have to say. We're here to talk about your document today, not the government's record. Let's talk about your document then. So you're saying that in order to beef up that audit process, to beef up that consultation process, that you want to throw extra resources at this, a tripling of staff numbers at the International Protection Office, a tripling of resources for the Appeals Tribunal. Has Sinn Féin worked out how much that's going to cost? I mean, you're talking about up to 1,000 civil servants. Are they going to be newly recruited members of the civil service, or are you going to take them from elsewhere? And if you are going to take them from elsewhere, what departments are you going to leave short-staffed?
Well, firstly, I have to refute again any notion that the type of consultation, the type of engagement with communities that we propose, that is our policy, is taking place. It's simply not. And the government...
Okay, we've heard you on that. Let's get to the question there, though.
Yes, and secondly, to say to you, you're misquoting the policy when we were talking about the tripling of capacity. The tripling of capacity is correct.
Tripling staff numbers at the IPO from 400 to 1,200, tripling of resources for the IPAT. I'm reading it from the document.
Yes.
So have you costed that, and where are they going to come from?
Excuse me, if you don't mind. That is not for the purpose of community engagement, as you have suggested. That is around the issue of efficient processing of applications. The number of international protection applications is growing very, very substantially. The system is very slow. The average application processing time is now 18 mm-hmm. months. That's simply too slow. It leaves the applicant in the invidious position of being in a very long limbo, and it means that there is a very late distinction between those who achieve international protection and who must stay and be cared for.
All of which is agreed. Have you costed this reallocation of human resources?
There is a costing for it. I don't have it to hand. It is not enormous. And let me tell you, whatever it is...
1,000 new civil servants is not an enormous cost?
Are you actually interested in hearing the policy or simply nitpicking with me? Whatever it costs, it needs to be done. By the way, the government, for your information, have accepted that capacity is too low. They're proposing to increase capacity, but far too slowly, far, far too slowly. Remember this, 2/3 of applications for international protection don't succeed for one reason or another. And it is imperative that those persons are respectfully and safely returned. Why? So that we have the capacity to integrate and to keep safe and give refuge to those who do qualify.
So, hang on a second. There is a costing. You don't have it, and you can't tell us at the moment where those civil servants would come from to commit to the IPO and the IPAT. I want to move on to the next thing, the next platform plank of this new policy. You want to move away from a reliance on the private market to remove profiteering. So does the government. Are you not again doing exactly as they're doing?
Well, first of all, I have to say that your tone with me in this interview is extremely rude. But be that as it may, the government may claim that this is their approach. It is something that they have failed to do. This was signposted 5 years ago by Catherine Day, and they still haven't done it. I'm less interested. And I would have thought, as a journalist and a broadcaster, you would be far more inquisitive, not simply around what the government is saying, which you're very happy to repeat ad nauseum, but actually what the government is doing, or in this case, has failed to do.
So are you committing then to what was recommended by Catherine Day and the Direct Provision Advisory Group?
Yes, it's the correct approach, yeah.
So you will build 6 and maybe up to 15 different asylum centres?
Yes.
Absolute categorical commitment.
Our categorical commitment is to move away from private profiteering and into public provision. I've said that, I think, extremely clearly. That is a necessary process. We have to have a system here in this state that works. I've described for you, you don't seem that keen on it, but I've described for you the community part of that. I've described for you, I hope, in a way that you have understood the need to protect social cohesion and public confidence. And part and parcel of that is having a planned approach that is state-led and that's driven by public investment and not private profiteering. Yes.
You want to amend the International Protection Act to allow for the partial designation of some countries as safe, presumably so that you can return people there. So which countries is it that you have in mind to declare as safe? And can you explain how is a country designated as partially safe?
Because although we live in a small island, other territories and countries are quite vast, and the political and social circumstances and the levels of safety or lack of safety can vary quite significantly. It's not for me arbitrarily to name countries. We're proposing here a policy approach that recognises those variations, which can be geographic, but they can also be determined by other factors. So, for example, certain territories or countries may not be safe for women or for gay people. And we think it's important that the system has the capacity and is sophisticated enough to recognise those differentials. It's a legal process through which those decisions are made. It is not arbitrary, and it's not a case of cherry picking or not cherry picking individual countries or territories.
When you make this another central plank of this policy document, there must be countries that you have in mind that are safe to designate for return.
No, what we have in mind is the global scenario where because of poverty, because of war, because of the climate crisis, large population movements are now a fact of the world that we live in. We may be a small island out on our own, but we are not immune to all of that. And this country has to have a thoughtful approach to how we deal respectfully, in a way that is humane, in a way that puts community front and centre, in a way that is efficient, for all of those challenges. So it's part of that formula.
Enforcement of deportation orders is another big plank in this document. Successive past ministers for justice have attempted this and have just said, it does not work. It sounds logical, but so very often these failed asylum applicants that huge resources are thrown into trying to track down have already left the jurisdiction.
And the difficulty is that there is no means of tracking that. And from the government's approach, excuse me, they haven't been very keen on actually tracking that at all.
Because it's a wild goose chase.
Well, no, I mean, I think that, you know, if you're here and you've made an application and you are in state-provided accommodation, we're not a vast territory such as Australia or otherwise. I think if the system is efficient, and again, this comes back to the processing times, and stepping that up, it's currently.
But what sort of resources do you? What sort of resources do you see yourself dedicating to this? I mean, do you envisage dedicated Department of Justice officials, Gardaí?
Philip, can I just say to you, the resources that are required? This is a policy document. I lead the opposition. I'm not the minister. I'm not the responsible party in government at this point. We have set out, I think, very clearly, a very balanced, a very clear methodology and approach and value system for dealing with this issue. Year on year, of course, the resource requirement will vary and it will have to be met. And that will be a matter for successive budgets. Those resources will be made available.
But Mary Lou, what is a policy document without costings, without an idea of what the resources required, other than a wish list?
No, policy documents set out the policy apparatus, the frameworks and the approach. I will listen with interest, Philip, and to your colleagues, as and when you have others setting out policy proposals and a similar demand for exact costing line by line. That's not what policy documents and position papers do, and you really should know that.
Everybody coming on here will receive exactly the same level of robust interrogation.
I'm delighted to hear it.
Are you making a political football, though, Mary Lou McDonnell, out of vulnerable asylum applicants by insisting on sending them to certain wealthy areas to make a political point? Because this reinforces the impression that these are people are an onerous burden that needs to be offloaded rather than human beings.
I've said nothing of the sort, and I don't appreciate you levelling that charge at me.
You said that you don't want to send them to deprived areas at all. That means, therefore, that you want to send them to wealthier areas.
Yeah, and I'm sorry if you find that difficult to comprehend, but I think any reasonable person would accept, because you're all human beings, because a person fleeing conflict and trauma needs support, and because of that very humanity, you do not, if you have any basic common sense, place that person in a community and in a setting that is stretched to the bone, where the food banks struggle. Communities like that, that is not a good idea.
Okay.
It's not a good idea for the applicants, and it is not a good idea for the community.
Mary Lou McDonald,
is our position.
Sinn Féin leader, TD for Dublin Central, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Text 51551, today with Clare Byrne on RTE Radio 1.